You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, good morning, and welcome to the sixth edition of A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. My name is Maga, and at the other end, not that far away geographically, is my good friend Matt. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning. Hey there, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you?
I'm fine. Not quite awake yet because I've definitely not had enough coffee, but hey, the day is still young.
Yeah, we do this very early, mainly because of me, probably. I don't know.
Nah.
This is the first podcast of the new year. How has it started for you, cineastically, culturally?
Generally, very well. Already on the 1st of January, we went to the cinema. I might talk a bit about that later. While we were at the cinema, we saw a poster for the 40th anniversary edition of Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And we realized that was on the 2nd of January and only then. So we went to the cinema basically on the first 2 days of the year. I think that is a very good start. We've again been to the cinema yesterday evening for The Killing of a Sacred Deer. Mm-hmm. We've started Stranger Things Season 2, which is perhaps not quite on the same level, but still a fun thing to do. Pop culturally in general, it's definitely been a good year so far. How about you?
I think I've started well. I used my time to watch some shorter series like Wormwood, Godless, and I also caught up with the later seasons of Black Mirror.
Okay.
The thing I would like to talk about today is it's a novel. It's The Leftovers by Tom Perrotta. I read that because I've seen all of the series now. The series is 3 seasons long. The novel pretty much covers the first season. It is really rather close to the series. There's the Garvey family, Kevin Garvey, the dad, Laurie Garvey, the mother, the 2 kids, Jill and Tom. They pretty much do what you see them do in season 1, except Kevin Garvey is not the new chief of police. He's the mayor. That's a major structural change. We get the point of view of any of the Garvey family members or Nora Durst. Nora Durst, in the series, she's working for the sudden departure insurance claims or whatever they call it. She's recording eyewitness accounts. She does not do that in the book. In the book, she got a hell of a lot of money because her whole family disappeared. And she just goes on bike tours around Mapleton. That's basically what she does. I would say that the characters are made a little bit more interesting in the series than they are in the book. The novel sort of gives them a lot of introspection. What's happening to me? Am I ever going to be happy again? Am I going to cope with the disappearance of this person or that person? Am I going to find my footing again? Of course, the series does that too, but there is much more introspection in the novel. The novel basically ends the same way that season 1 ends. That's sort of a spoiler if you either want to read the novel or want to watch the series. I liked it, but I think the series fleshes stuff out much better. The novel sort of refuses to use any supernatural aspects, and of course sometimes the series does that quite heavily, even in the later seasons. The novel is just about the disappearance of 2% of the world's population and about the people who got left behind, and that's mm-hmm. it. If there are supernatural elements, they are in your head. In the series, there are clearly other points to make. It goes further than just it's all in your head. No, it's a good novel. I read it out of curiosity. I'm glad that I've read it, but it's not. I don't think it's one of my favorites.
It's actually strange, you know, yesterday when we watched The Killing of a Sacred Deer, I was actually also, it made me think of The Leftovers, the series. I think it's probably that, in a way, the premise, there may be forces bigger than us, there might be Igor or something, but most mm-hmm. likely he does not care about us. He does whatever he wants to do and we're left picking up the pieces. There's also that kind of, how should I put this, metaphysical framework in The Killing of a Sacred Deer, except in The Leftovers, I very much felt that we, as the audience, were given so much space to, you know, relate, not just intellectually, but also emotionally to these characters. Some of them we might like, some of them we might hate, some of them might annoy us, some of them might confuse us, but there's space there for us to have an emotional reaction. And in Sacred Deer, I felt that there was no space for that at all for the longest time. It's basically, I'm probably going to blog about this, so I don't want to say too much, but that film struck me as rather cruel and suffocating. And I haven't yet figured out whether I think there's a point to its cruelty and its suffocating feel. I think that if the film does not want us to have any sort of reaction to what's going on, or doesn't give us the space for that reaction, it makes me kind of wonder, why is it doing what it's doing? It's not like that for the whole film, but it's definitely there at the beginning, and I think that's something that made me resent the film a bit. I think also The Leftovers has moments when it depicts a very cruel, almost sadistic, and at the very least uncaring universe, but the people left behind, the people who have to deal with all of these weird things happening, they're still relatable. Not sentimentally so, but they are relatable.
Yeah, I think in The Leftovers you find your point of entry. You can sort of relate to someone somewhere, or even to multiple characters, aspects of multiple characters. When you have movies that go from bad to worse, it's sort of hard to follow. The movie asks you to follow them on a downward spiral, and at some point you are tempted to quit. And if you quit, the movie does no longer work for you.
Exactly. No, I think so too.
Yeah, to brighter pastures. I think we have plans to go to a galaxy far, far away, a long, long time ago. Isn't that right? Tell us.
Okay, I almost feel that I have to start with... Although I think that's probably no longer accurate. I don't think 20th Century Fox has anything to do with Star Wars anymore. But in my head, at least, Star Wars begins with the 20th Century Fox logo now and forever. Amen. In any case, as I said, on the 1st of January, we went to the cinema, and the film that we went to see was The Last Jedi. I think it is probably the most debated Star Wars movie yet, even with the prequels that were basically torn to shreds by fans. You had fans basically screaming and crying and wailing and gnashing their teeth at the prequels. But I think The Last Jedi has created more debate, more argument, also more, I don't know, screaming from people who think that it's completely destroyed Star Wars, which I think is odd. Perhaps we can talk about that later, but to begin with... I am one of those people who liked The Force Awakens, the start of the new trilogy, well enough, but it was definitely not a brilliant film. It was a fun film, but it very much felt like they were basically redoing the original trilogy. It felt like they were redoing A New Hope. And in that respect, I think that The Force Awakens felt, at least to me, like a cover band, you know, doing all the greatest hits by the Beatles or the greatest hits of the Rolling Stones. And it was a good cover band. They did those greatest hits really well. But it also makes you think at some point, so why am I not watching the original? You know, you remember in The Force Awakens, basically there are so many things that you've got a desert planet. It's not Tatooine, but basically it is Tatooine. Yeah. You've got not a Death Star, but basically it is a Death Star, just bigger and badder. You've got a new emperor, basically. He's not called the emperor, but functionally he's pretty much the same. Yeah. There's so much there that makes you feel, okay, this is not even a remix. It's almost a remake.
Yeah.
There are some elements, or there were some elements to The Force Awakens that I think surpassed that, went beyond that. I think that the primary antagonist, Kylo Ren, that many viewers actually hated because he's a bit of a whiny, emo, millennial idiot. I thought actually that was interesting because we didn't get, you know, Darth Vader warmed up in the microwave. We got someone who wants to be Darth Vader, who desperately wishes to be Darth Vader, and fails at doing that because he simply isn't. He's trying to copy or imitate and therefore define himself as something that's already been done. And I thought that was actually really interesting because it didn't just copy, it commented on this whole thing of, are we redoing Star Wars? Are we trying to recapture something that's, you know, 40 years ago? And can we even do that? Are we perhaps not doomed to fail because the best we can do is, you know, do the same thing again? So there were traces of interesting ideas in The Force Awakens, but mostly it just was, it was a reset button, I felt. It was, you know, as I said, let's go back, imitate what worked before, imitate it really well, and hope that that's enough. And when we came to The Last Jedi, for one thing, I was more excited about this one, but I also didn't know what to expect, because J.J. Abrams, who directed The Force Awakens, he's, I think, very good at pastiche. He's very good at imitation. He's a good cover band director. I mean, if you watch something like, what was it called? Super 8? Very much feels like, you know, I've watched Spielberg, I like Spielberg, let's see if I can do Spielberg. And specifically, 80s Spielberg. Mm-hmm. And I think it did that pretty well. But at the same time, you always had to wonder, so I could be watching actual Spielberg while doing this, right? And Spielberg is still better at it. So I think J.J. Abrams, he did what he does well. But Rian Johnson, the guy who was basically asked to direct The Last Jedi, Episode 8, he was a wild card. If you look at his earlier films, I've not seen all of them, but I've seen Looper and I've seen Brick, both of which I liked a lot. Both are genre movies, but both are also kind of postmodern subversive takes on genre. In one case, the kind of time travel adventure, in the other case, the basically film noir. And I think Brick especially, where you've got film noir at an American high school, mm-hmm. was really intriguing. I'd not seen that kind of film before. That did take up, how should I put this? It took up the tropes of film noir and the tropes of the high school movie, but it mixed them together in a way that felt extremely fresh and unexpected. And in that respect, he's not the first person you think of when you want to do Star Wars, especially if you consider, you know, Star Wars is now owned or has been owned for a while now by Disney. Disney is not the first company I think of when I think of creative risk. And getting in Rian Johnson to do Episode 8 is a creative risk. I think it's a creative risk that paid off in some ways, not 100% in all ways. To make it a bit brief, I enjoyed The Last Jedi. I enjoyed it a lot. I thought it was fun. It was funny. It was exciting. It was also a mess. I think it's a tonal mess. It's a structural mess. I think it's a film that felt mm-hmm. like it needed several script revisions. I think the ideas in it, the themes in it, are intriguing, exciting. I think he does a really cool thing in that he subverts old Star Wars, but he also embraces it. He's clearly a fan. And mm-hmm. I think in many ways, the film is a love letter to the fans, even if many fans didn't realize that it was that. I think it's a film that is in love with Star Wars as, how should I put this? Basically, it sees Star Wars as something that can be simplistic, can be almost cannibalistic in how it just repeats the past over and over again. But Star Wars is also something that can inspire, that can basically, Star Wars can be the supreme escapism, but in an inspiring way, mm-hmm. making you think about, you know, yourself as something else, something more than what you are. I'm talking especially about kids now, and I think Star Wars, even though, you know, many of us enjoyed it as adults, most of us probably came to it as kids. And I remember myself, I didn't see any of them at the cinema when I was a kid. I actually, my first encounter with Star Wars was on a Betamax tape that my uncle had recorded for us. Sent it to Switzerland. We watched it. I loved it. This was a new magical world. I think it was the first time that I was kind of exposed to this kind of alternative world that I could dream myself into. It was familiar in the sense that it was a fairy tale world with knights and bad guys and wizards. They just had different names. But it also was visually creative. It made this new world real for me just by means of its visual power. So we watched it. I loved it. My parents didn't see the point because neither of them is into genre cinema, into science fiction, or into anything fantastic. So the very next day, they kind of recorded over that Betamax tape. I think they recorded a football match or something. At least in my mind, it was a football match, which makes it even worse.
Yeah, that's
but
bad.
The point is that Star Wars, the original, when I was a kid, completely grabbed my imagination. And I think for many children around that time, it was probably one of the first times that they were transported into a different world that did not seem hokey and fake, like in, you know, the special effects of the 50s and 60s. But it felt real. It felt like you could be in that world. You, as a kid, you could want to be an X-Wing pilot, a Jedi. You wanted to be Han Solo. And I don't remember having had that before watching Star Wars to that extent. So it was very much an entry drug into a very specific kind of escapism. And I think Rian Johnson values that.
Yeah. I have to say, I liked The Last Jedi quite a bit. But I'm only very slowly coming to sci-fi. I never really liked sci-fi. The same is true for fantasy. Maybe because I saw the wrong things. I saw stereotypical sci-fi, stereotypical fantasy. Fantasy meaning medieval plus magic, you know, knights with magical powers, wizards.
Dungeons and Dragons type stuff, basically.
Something like that, yeah. And I thought, if it's that stereotypical, after you've seen two or three of them, good ones or bad ones, you've basically seen it. And I still have some sort of suspicion or maybe even resistance to other fantasy things. I'm sort of hesitant to watch Game of Thrones properly because I'm almost sure that it's not for me. I don't say I don't like the genre. It's too easy to dismiss a whole genre. I don't do that because there are even country songs I like, you know, and as a general rule, I don't like country.
Some of my best friends are country songs.
Exactly, yes.
So when you were a kid, did you have anything else that kind of, that you obsessed about in terms of pop culture? I mean, you obviously didn't imagine yourself as Luke Skywalker or Han Solo or even Chewbacca. I guess some weird kids think they want to be Chewbacca. Did you have anything like that as a kid?
A point of identification. I listened, no, not movie or TV series wise, that never happened, but I had a radio that I listened to any waking minute. I was a music guy. Movies and TV came later. I was on the side of music.
So you were basically born as a teenager?
No, but I think I explained it in episode 5 that that sounds like Star Wars. Yeah. You can also roar like a lion if you want to.
I think I'll rather do it.
I grew up in a place with no movie theaters. You had to travel 25 minutes to go to the next movie theater. And I realized late in life that such things existed at all. TV, we had two or three TV stations, not much on. It was boring. So there was music. So I can't tell you when exactly I saw episode 4, 5 and 6. I think I saw episode 4 long after episode 6 was already out. I'm pretty sure I didn't see any of them on the big screen. I saw them on TV somewhere, maybe synchronized in German, and I thought, oh, all right, that was fun, but that was it. I never quite saw how you could enter that world. I didn't see the attraction. I didn't see the addiction you could have to such things. I knew it existed, but I think I was much more an Indiana Jones guy. But still, I wasn't someone who sort of bought the sticker book or the T-shirt or even bought a hat and a whip or something like that. Not at all. It was there. It was escapism, and that was it. And then back to real life.
Yeah. I mean, I do think that with Star Wars especially, it's best if you can in a way get into it as a child, as I did. And, you know, then for a long time, basically, I think I watched Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi only years and years and years later. At the time, I remember that films took much longer to be shown on TV, in Switzerland at least. They were dubbed into German. And it's not the kind of thing that we went to see as a family anyway. So I think I saw A New Hope, so the first Star Wars movie, probably when I was, I don't know, 7 or 8. And I then only saw the later ones when I was about 12, possibly even a bit older. But I think the seed had already been planted. I also remember that at some point I got one of these, at a toy store, I saw a catalogue, you know, for action figures and all of these models of, you know, whether it was AT-AT walkers or TIE fighters, X-Wings. And that was enough, you know, it was like, okay, I've been turned into an addict at an early age, and then it only took very little of the drug to keep me going till I could get my next big fix, which was kind of 5-6 years down the road. But it still worked. I mean, I remember poring over that toy catalogue and thinking, I would really like one of those Millennium Falcon models, and I would really like one of those X-Wings. And then imagining myself flying around like kids do, like most kids do who watch, you know, these films at an early enough age.
Mm-hmm.
But I also get the impression, I mean, this is not something I can talk about from my own experience, but I read about many, many people my age who have kids who saw Star Wars when they were kids themselves, when they were 5, 6, 7, and who loved them back then, who might have had a bit of a, I don't know, crisis of faith with the prequels. But then they had kids and they could introduce their kids to these films.
Yeah.
With the risk always that the kids might like the Ewoks best and that they might like mm-hmm. the prequels best, which of course would then, you know, launch another crisis of faith. But my impression is that Star Wars can be a really nice thing to pass on to your children. And I mean, you yourself said that you're not really a Star Wars fan in that respect. Mm. You didn't watch it as a kid. You never became an addict.
No.
But if I'm not mistaken, your daughter quite likes the films, right?
Yeah, yeah, she does. She's seen all of them. She after we've seen The Force Awakens, she confessed to me that I don't think I really like Rey that much. She's okay, but you know. And then we went to see The Last Jedi, and over the weekend she did some kind of new hairstyle, those three little spikes on the back of her head, you know, the mm-hmm. same way that Rey has. And she went to school like that, and I thought, okay, somebody has you know, has been awakened in a way. So it's, she's much more into it than me. She's also very much in the Marvel universe, something mm-hmm. we simply didn't have, at least not to that extent, when I was a kid. That's what she grows up with. She also grows up with slightly harder stuff like Supernatural, Stranger Things, things like that. I think it's nice to grow up with that kind of pop culture.
Mm-hmm. Is it, I mean, has it to some extent allowed you to watch these films and series through her eyes as well?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there's stuff we watch together. For instance, Jessica Jones. There are other things that she watches on her own. Like Supernatural. I'm not very much interested in, what are they called, Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki.
They're the two pretty boys, right?
They're the two brothers, the pretty boys, yes. And Leia is very much a fangirl now. She's got t-shirts and hoodies and things like that.
Well, teenagers will be teenagers.
That's true. And for me, that's already too much of a formula, of a stereotype. Mm-hmm. Sometimes somebody interesting turns up in those series. Titus Welliver, Jim Beaver,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of have a look, and then after one or two episodes, my interest flags, and then I stop. I let the whole series of Supernatural be entirely her own thing. She's absolutely entitled to make her own discoveries mm-hmm. without daddy beside her, you know.
Yeah.
She's old enough now. So that's what she likes. There must be a series that's entirely yours when you grow up. And she's decided that Supernatural is for her, that Gilmore Girls is for her.
Mm-hmm.
That was earlier, before Supernatural. Stuff like that, you know.
Except in your case, as you said, it was music, not TV or films.
For me, it was very much music, yeah.
I mean, it's, I don't think I started listening to music much till I was much, much older. So for me, it was the other way around, but I was very much a book reader. And I read a lot of fantasy, also a lot of bad, bad fantasy. But I think as a kid, I very much looked for escapism of one way, of one kind or another.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's different reading escapist stuff or watching escapist stuff as a kid than it is as a grown-up. I think as a kid, it's not just about escaping into a better world. You know, you might have bad times at school, you might be bullied, you might be the slow one, the one who's not good at sports. So there's definitely that element of imagining yourself into a world that's more exciting. But I think it's also about how do you want to define yourself as a person. And as a kid, especially, I think you look to inspiring characters, and these inspiring characters might be rather childishly conceived to some extent. I mean, there's not all that much depth to old school Luke Skywalker or Han Solo. Mm-hmm. They're very much comic book characters, I would say, to some extent. But I think as a kid, that's what you latch on to. Strong personalities,
yeah.
Brightly drawn, clearly drawn characters. You don't look for, I don't know, as a kid, you're not going to look for a Walter White just without as much violence and drugs. You're going to look for a Luke Skywalker. You're going to look for, if you're going to go for someone more ambiguous, you're going to go for a Han Solo. Or as a girl, I would imagine you're going to look at Leia, Princess Leia, and think, you know, okay, mm-hmm. She's a princess, but she also knows how to shoot a blaster and fight with the best of them.
Yeah.
What was that like for your daughter? Do you feel that, you know, having kind of female pop culture idols, is that something that's important to her? Is that something that you think has been good for her?
I think so. She tends to prefer female role models. I just gave evidence to the contrary that she likes Jensen Ackles and Jared Padalecki or whatever his name is. And that she sort of took her time to warm up to Rey. But she loves Gilmore Girls. I mean, there are two ambitious women, clearly. She likes Jessica Jones, although her screensaver is Kilgrave.
That is scary.
That is that's a little bit scary, yes, yes. But, I mean, the baddies are often more interesting and slightly sexier than the goodies, you know.
Although, don't say anything against Jessica Jones, of course.
No, that's not... No, she... I think she is looking forward to the second season. It's going to come out in March or something. There is another series. It's called Shadowhunters. Mm-hmm. It's absolutely not for me. I can see that from afar, even with the sound off. And the strongest character, the central character, is a girl, young woman, who discovers that she's some kind of shadow hunter, and there's a whole coven of shadow hunters that are the first, last, and only line of defense, whatever. I can't get into the plot in any detail because I don't know exactly what happens, but it's basically forces of good versus forces of darkness, and that's mm-hmm. it. And the main character is a girl who's on the good side, so she watches a lot of strong female role models.
Has she watched any Buffy?
No, we discussed that, but maybe at a later point. I think season one is not really sprinkled with brilliance, is it? There seem to be some very, very hackneyed and bad episodes.
It's rough. I think it's not as bad as other first seasons. I think something like Star Trek, The Next Generation, did much worse in its first season. I think Buffy, it takes a while to get going, and it is cheesy. I mean, it's a TV series from the 90s with special effects. And back then, special effects for TV were bad. They were cheap. Mm-hmm. And I think that always kind of creates a kind of barrier. But I think Joss Whedon, especially in Buffy, did a fantastic job of having relatable characters, of having inspiring or inspirational characters.
Mm-hmm.
But then also, you know, you talked about the goodies versus baddies, the kind of Manichaean black and white worldview. And I think Joss Whedon usually does a good job of having bad guys, good guys, but also having more ambiguous characters, having bad guys that have some kind of, you know, pathos that works, and having good guys that are actually also ambivalent.
Mm-hmm.
So in that respect, that's something that, even though as a kid I grew up loving Star Wars, I also, from the first film onwards, I never was the kind of guy who thought, you know, yeah, kill Darth Vader. Was always, even as a kid, I was the kind of sentimental guy who preferred, you know, the potential of, you know, redeeming the bad guys. You know, I find it boring if basically bad guys are there to be killed by the good guys. This kind of, you know, 50s black and white Western movies, good and bad thing. And I never liked that, not even as a kid. I always minded that about fairy tales. I always thought, wouldn't it be great if we could talk to the monsters and kind of talk them out of being monsters? I guess I was a bleeding heart liberal even as a 5-year-old. And, you know, I always then thought, yeah, the likes of Darth Vader, you know, you could redeem him, you know, you could bring him back to the good side. And then, hey, presto, what happens in episode 6? So I always, even though I like to some extent, you know, the kind of the imagination and the familiarity, the combination of those two things in the fairy tale universes of Star Wars, I also think that they are limited and that I want more than that. And I think in that respect, to come back to The Last Jedi, I think that's one thing I found intriguing, that throughout the film, perhaps until the very end, you have the impression that Kylo Ren struggles with the role that he tries to take for himself. He starts off wanting to be Darth Vader, but in a way, his heart isn't really in it. He's a teenager. I mean, he's rebelling against his parents. Mm. And yeah, I mean, you could say that killing your dad, especially if your dad is Han Solo, makes him kind of irredeemable. But he struggles. And I think that's where it helps that the new Star Wars films, by and large, have actors who are much better at nuanced characterization than, you know, the likes of Mark Hamill and co.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that there weren't good actors also in the old films, but I think there was definitely less nuance there. And I think with Rey in the new film, with Kylo Ren, with many of the others, there is a more differentiated look at, you know, who's a bad guy, who's a good guy, who's a hero. And I think that's one of the things that actually many fans dislike. Of course, it doesn't help that many fans also see, you know, the heroic males being taken down a peg or two, especially with, what's his name? Dameron Poe?
Yeah.
Where if you look at him, he's someone who, he's supposed to be the classical Han Solo slash Luke Skywalker hero.
Yeah.
He's, you know, fantastic pilot, and he's basically the kind of rebellious guy who takes a one in a million chance.
Yeah.
And what happens in The Last Jedi? He screws up. He gets people killed. He gets many, many people killed because he thinks, yeah, well, I'm a rebel. I'm the good guy. I'm the hero. And I like that the film basically says, no, sometimes these people are not the heroes. Sometimes they're the stupid ones who get you killed.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, as I said, some fans basically just saw, oh, well, they're taking men down a peg. You know, it's political correctness and feminism and social justice warrior culture gone mad. And at that point, I just think, you know, some of those fans should take a look at the original Star Wars movies where, you know, yes, you had heroic Luke Skywalker, you had, you know, cocky hero Han Solo, but you also had Princess Leia. And you had not just the big shiny heroes, you also had tiny weirdo, kind of deranged Jedi Master Yoda. I think there's a lot more in the old films that is actually already a bit subversive. But the fans have forgotten it.
Yeah. Maybe The Last Jedi is not that much for kids anymore. I can see myself watching the original trilogy with a lot of popcorn. With The Last Jedi, I want to really watch it because other stuff happens. There are aspects that are tailored for kids, you know, that those little guinea pigs standing on their hind legs, they look like, you know.
The kind of bird, guinea pig hybrids, the pork, exactly.
Yeah, yeah, but even Leia was complaining that, you know, Chewbacca eats one of those. So it's not that much for kids anymore. So if you make a movie for teens or young grown-ups, let's say, give them controversy. Don't give them stereotypes. There are a lot of great stereotypes in the other movies, but you can give them a little more depth, a little more to do. Let them screw up a bit, make them deeper. Mm-hmm. Why not? It certainly adds to the quality. If people don't get that depth, why the hell are they rooting or not rooting for their characters? Why don't they change the series? You know, go somewhere else. I mean, I don't think The Last Jedi has destroyed anything. It has added to the whole Star Wars saga.
I think so too. No, I think that's what I find a shame about a certain kind of fan culture. It's this, you know, looking at the thing that they're fans of as, you know, for one thing, it's mine. Don't change anything about it. It's my precious, basically. And then anyone who adds to that is seen as, you know, heretics. You know, they're destroying my childhood. That's rubbish, I think. I agree with you, you know. One of the things that drew me to the Star Wars universe was that it felt big. It felt like a lot of stories could happen in this universe. And in that case, you know, why return to the same tropes? You know, if the universe is potentially infinite, the fictional universe, why go back to yet another desert planet? Why build yet another Death Star? Why have yet another empire? Why have yet another, you know, and so on and so forth? And I think The Last Jedi takes all of these elements, plays with them. It does criticize them to some extent. It still loves them, but it adds something to it. I mean, some of the film irritated me. Some of that was its messiness. Some of that was that I think its pacing is all over the place. I do think that in terms of sheer craftsmanship, you know, the kind of thing that I think Empire Strikes Back did fantastically, I think The Last Jedi is a mess. It's, for me, a lovable mess, and it's an interesting mess. Some of the things that irritated me, though, were just that I didn't quite understand what Johnson was doing, because he was doing something fairly different. Mm-hmm. And it was not instead of, but it was in addition to what had come before. I don't think, as I said, I think the script would have needed some work. You know, I think, for instance, the whole Dameron Poe story with Laura Dern's character called Vice Admiral Hondo, I think.
Something, yeah.
I Hondo. Think that plot doesn't proceed as well as it could, mainly because, you know, she doesn't tell him anything about the plan. She doesn't need to tell him anything about the plan. But because she keeps things from him, and because it's so clearly flagged as I am keeping things from you, that's one of the reasons why the bad things happen, why people die. I think you can tell that story, but I don't think they told it as well as they could have. Mm-hmm. So in that respect, I think it is a shame that they didn't revise the script a bit. What I think is much more of a shame, though, is that the third film, I think originally it was, what's his name, Cory Doctorow, who was supposed to direct it, right?
Yeah.
And from what I hear, he's screwed up in major ways over the last couple of movies he's done. I have no problems with him not directing Episode 9, but I think it's a massive shame that they're returning to J.J. Abrams to direct Episode 9. Exactly, because, as I said, I think J.J. Abrams is a great cover band, but his covers all sound like the original, and we've already had the original. Mm. We've now seen something that was weird, unexpected, not always successful, but surprising, and that also, for me at least, invigorated what Star Wars could be. And we're going back to the cover band. And I think a lot of the stuff in The Last Jedi will, for me at least, depend on how do they resolve the story. I think, you know, especially Rey's path and Kylo Ren's path has gone in interesting directions, but it's not completed yet. And depending on how they finish that story, if they go back to, you know, same old, predictable stuff, it's also going to make The Last Jedi more of a failed experiment. At the moment, it's an experiment that I think could pay off fantastically. But if they just go back to, you know, what is safe, what they've done before, you know, we could have another Death Star and it's even bigger. And this time it destroys two suns at once. And, you know, we could have someone who's a bit like the Emperor, an old bad guy who tries to kind of manipulate Kylo Ren.
Yeah.
I don't know. Yeah. I think, you know, I will definitely go and watch Episode 9 when they show it. That's going to be in 2 years' time, I think, right?
I think so.
But I am definitely not, I'm not pessimistic, but let's put it like this. I'm wary of what they'll do with it. And I think the next Star Wars film is going to be Han Solo, which I think they plan to show this spring. There hasn't been a trailer yet. Mm-hmm. And they've got good people. They've got good actors. But at the same time, you know, why go back to the stuff that's already been told? Of course, we have not had young Solo yet, but we've had fairly young Han Solo. We know what he's like. I'm just afraid that we're going to go back to cover band stuff.
Yeah. If you could choose the director for Episode 9, do you have a wish list?
Well, obviously David Lynch, because they wanted him for Return of the Jedi, and that didn't work out. And, you know, he's done so well with science fiction, so no, not David Lynch.
All right.
I think I would have been interested in seeing Rian Johnson doing it again, but he's going to get his own trilogy of Star Wars movies, I think, that's not directly connected to the episodes. I'm wondering, what's the director's name? We talked about him a bit last time. He did Mud, he did Midnight Special.
Oh, name escapes me right now, but I know who you mean. Yeah.
I'll just quickly look up his name because it's otherwise right. It's going to pester me till.
Yeah.
Jeff Nichols.
Jeff Nichols. Now exactly. There's a name to remember. Yeah.
I always get confused because I then think of Mike Nichols and Jeff Daniels, and somehow he's and
Jack
you know,
Nicholson.
Exactly. So I think someone like him might be interesting. He's shown that he can work with genre,
yeah.
But he also brings something unique and different to it. He's got a signature style, and I think I would rather have directors who have signature styles than directors that can basically imitate well. You know, I think they got Ron Howard in as a kind of replacement director for Han Solo, and I like Ron Howard's mm-hmm. movies. They're all enjoyable, but he's not got much of a signature style. He feels very much like, you know, someone who's watched his Spielbergs and who can do a reasonable job of giving you that Spielberg feeling, but who isn't Spielberg. And I think in that respect, I want someone with a signature style. If I wanted to really piss off fans, especially male fans of a certain kind, I would say, let's get in Sophie Coppola for episode 9. The Jedi Suicides. Wouldn't that be a great title?
The Jedi Suicides. Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, but that would be such a downer in a way. You know, it would be more depressing than even Rogue One. So
yeah, but it would have good pop music.
Yeah.
And we could have Bill Murray in there as a Jedi Master.
Playing himself. You know,
I like that.
I've always been a Jedi Master.
Exactly. You know,
like in Zombieland.
Exactly. It all makes sense.
Yeah.
Alternatively, we could have Wes Anderson's episode 9 in stop motion animation.
That would work. That would work. It's like that scene in animated Star Wars does work. I mean, there's that. Didn't you tell me one time about that robot chicken sketch?
Exactly.
Yeah.
They did some good stuff. Of course, it's not. I mean, then it would definitely not be for kids. Then it would firmly be for sarcastic teenagers and grown-ups who want to be sarcastic teenagers.
Yeah.
But no, I think that could work, except then the fans would probably go, you did a bad film, PT.
Yeah. My choice is not that unrealistic. It's also someone we talked about last time. Ava DuVernay, she's done a sci-fi movie that's not out yet. It's called The Wrinkle in Time, based mm-hmm. on a young adult novel, I think.
Mm-hmm.
A Wrinkle in Time is starts out in real life, but then has some sci-fi aspects. It's with Reese Witherspoon, Chris Pine, as a disappeared scientist father, and kids having special abilities, stuff like that. If she can pull of A Wrinkle in Time, I strongly recommend her for episode 9.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the people who cut out all the women out of The Last Jedi don't want a lady to direct episode 9, do they?
Yeah.
Bastards.
You know, they might ruin our Star Wars with their breasts and periods and stuff.
Oh, man.
Well, I think in that respect, a cup has passed through by you not getting into science fiction at a young age and you not becoming a big, big, big fan because, you know, so many of them are disappointed and, you know, kind of pounding their breasts now at the sheer horror of social justice warriors having taken over Star Wars. So perhaps you're the lucky one.
Well, I don't know. It's the road not taken. All I can say is the rogue not taken. No, I never had a dislike for it. It's just fantasy and science fiction are probably two of those genres that have to fight against stereotypes the most. You know, you can have any kind of real life drama; it's perfectly acceptable. There are stereotypes, but it's not the genre that is famous for repeating stereotypes, although it does, maybe to the same extent that there are, medieval magic wizards in any kind of fantasy. If you hear fantasy, you think of swords and horses and knights and wizards.
Mm-hmm. And dragons, lots and lots of dragons.
And dragons, of course, yeah. Sometimes a monster with a ring, but that's optional. So,
exactly.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for that discussion. It was great fun.
Absolutely. I also enjoyed it.
We were standing a little bit on opposite sides. I think you are very much a follower of sci-fi and me not so much. That was interesting.
I really enjoyed this also, bringing in the perspective of someone who's not a fan, but who's got a daughter who's a fan. So
yeah.
Thanks very much for bringing that in.
Sure, anytime. That's it. It's almost an hour. Oh, wow, not bad.
We're getting longer and longer at this.
We're getting longer. We're getting better. More to say. That's good. Yeah. Thanks a lot for listening. That was episode 6. Snicker, snicker. Sorry, maybe you have to cut that out. That was episode 6, the first one of 2018. We hope the year has started well for you, as well as it has started for us. That's bye from me, Maga.
And bye from me, Matt. See you next month. Bye.
See you later. Bye-bye. Ba 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 ba